from WXXI News. This is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. As always, I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's begin our week in review with an internationally acclaimed author whose debut novel is set during the Second American Civil War. The year is 2075, and most of the southeastern United States is underwater as a result of climate change. The government has banned the use of fossil fuels, and the southern states have revolted.
Omar Al-Akkad's book is called American War, but it's not really a book about war or even climate change. It's about what moves a person to commit acts of terrorism and mass murder. The protagonist in the book begins as a six-year-old girl named Surat, who grows to become a woman driven by revenge. Now, the book asks us to consider the totality of a person and their actions, not to excuse terrorism, but to try to grapple with the complexity of it.
I'm 37 years old, which means the entirety of my adult life essentially has taken place in the sort of post-war on terror age, the post-9/11 age. And to me, that's an age defined by the statement when George W. Bush gets up and says, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, which I fully understand that sentiment. I've never once in my life been subjected to injustice and then responded by instinctively turning to nuance. That's not how people react when they're subjected to that sort of thing. But it also was an obliteration of gray space, an obliteration of everything in between. I was at this faculty event at the University of Toronto, and I was talking about this notion that we have an obligation to understand why somebody does something, particularly something evil, and that by doing this, we're not taking their side. And I got pushback from a professor who said something to the extent of, well, no, that's not right. We don't do this. We don't spend time trying to figure out why the Nazis did what they did. And my response was, yes, we do. We spend a lot of time doing it. It's not because we want to be their friends. It's because we want to understand how this sort of thing happens in the hopes that we can stop it from happening in the future. And so that, for me, is sort of the central idea of the book, is that we have an obligation to understand how somebody gets to the dark place. We can't just, when they finally get there, feign surprise and shock and outrage and then move on to the next thing.
I guess they were always evil, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it would be a much more straightforward world if they were. And there's part of me that genuinely would be comforted if there were just some people who are plainly evil, and that's who they are, and that's how they got there. I don't think most of the world works that way. I don't think people are fundamentally evil to begin with. And if they are, I think it's a rounding error compared to the kind of evil they can become when the world subjects them to damage.
I think quite the opposite. I think people are fundamentally good. I think kids are, just the experience of being around children, I think kids become mean, kids bully, kids become nasty, kids will become violent, kids will judge others. Most of the time, they have to be taught to do that. Kids have an amazing sense of fairness. I mean, even if you just let kids to their own devices and tend to have great senses of empathy. They're competitive, but they don't like to see others hurting. So I think Surat is a great example, and to me, a phenomenal vehicle to help us understand this. But I don't think it's inevitable that human beings must, in some non-zero percentage, be this violent. I don't think we have to accept that, well, in a world with 7 billion people, there will always be some level of terrorism and mass murder. Do you think it's inevitable?
No, and I mean, I would hope that people are capable of reacting with love, and I would hope that people are capable of rising above the damage to which they are subjected. The question this book asks is, how do we think about somebody who doesn't? How do we think about somebody who experiences that trauma and then decides to propagate it? And so, you know, calling them evil, which, you know, by the end of this book, I believe the central character to be a fundamentally evil human being, that's not enough.
You would put it that way, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, my relationship with Surat is somewhat strange. I love her dearly, but I don't like her. I don't like the person she becomes. And that's an odd relationship to have with a character. But no, I don't think you're obligated to apologize for this character. I don't think you're obligated to sympathize with them. I simply want you to understand how they end up in the place where they end up.
We turn now to an important anniversary in American history. We're approaching 50 years since the Stonewall Inn riots in New York City. Those riots launched the gay liberation movement. They began in the early morning hours when police tried to raid the bar and arrest patrons suspected of being gay or transgender.
But the patrons and bartenders had had enough. They resisted arrest, surrounded police, and eventually lit the bar on fire. The rioting lasted several days. It convinced gay people across the country to resist arrest and to organize for their rights. The city of Rochester is working with the local public libraries to create an exhibition called Stonewall 50 Years Out. The reception is set for Friday, April 5th. In this clip, you'll hear activist Jeremy Chung talking about the meaning of Stonewall. But first, this is activist and artist Adrian Elam.
Without the black and brown trans community, there would be no Stonewall riots. There would be no Stonewall uprising. It's the folks. I think it's important to understand like the intersection of being black, being queer, being trans, and then the fact that that fight was against police around the same time that, again, the larger civil rights movement was combating police brutality and racism and kind of the synergy that was happening. Because even once the gay liberation movement started, even the Black Panthers were supportive of the movement and said, you know, they recognized the idea that our liberation is very much tied to theirs and vice versa. And so, again, I think over the course of time, those folks who had started, because I remember there was a movie that came out like 3 years ago where they really tried to center some gay white boys, like the starter of Stonewall, and I was like, y'all are doing a lot. That's Hollywood, but I think it's important to recenter those stories and those folks who, without whom, the gay liberation movement would not be in existence. And even still today, even in this community, there are so many, particularly black trans women who are my dear friends, who are putting in so much incredible work in this community, and they do it without thanks, and a lot of time they go unnoticed. And again, it's important to center those folks and those stories and their experiences and making sure we're supporting them.
Jeremy, I can't imagine what it must have been like 1969 when the patrons at Stonewall, some of the bartenders decided that's it. Like, police don't just get to come here and say we're arresting a trans woman because of dress. We're arresting for gay acts or suspicion. That's a lot of courage, knowing what could come your way.
I think going back to Don's call, I think it's important for everybody to remember that Stonewall was a riot, not a parade. And as we kind of reflect back on the last 50 years of the movement, we need to know that it started with civil disobedience and a reaction against oppression. You know, we need to capture the rage, but we also need to capture the joy of the community. But we can't forget the rage in the celebration of this. It's also a commemoration of lives lost and battles fought.
Next, a conversation about gender, sexuality, and religion, and how they all relate to climate change. Peterson Toscano is a theatrical performance activist who travels the world speaking about the intersection of those issues. Sometimes he uses storytelling about his own experiences as a gay man in the evangelical Christian church, and sometimes he incorporates character monologues. He was in Rochester this week to work with local students.
Toscano says the key to having conversations about heavy subjects like climate change is to find a relatable point at which an individual can connect with another. In this clip, he discusses how after nearly 2 decades of conversion therapy and grappling with the strictures of his church, he came to accept himself as normal and natural. You'll hear him make connections to climate and nature as well.
It was many years ago. It's interesting. I came to Rochester for the first time to hear Billy Graham at a crusade many years ago. It must have been in the 80s. And it was this whole world I had. It was my life. So it was complicated because I was told I could not be gay and Christian. So I definitely knew I could no longer be part of the churches I was part of. And I had to not just come out of the closet, but I had to question everything and restart my life in my mid-30s and trying to figure out who am I, what do I care about, what's important to me. And it was a very challenging time.
Now, in this state and even in this city, it's only been recently that we've seen bans for so-called conversion therapy, which I think most of our listeners would be familiar with by now. That's the idea that you can convert the gay out of somebody. And you spent years really trying that, right? And actually spent a lot of money on that.
Yeah, 17 years and over $30,000 on 3 continents trying not to be gay, involved in conversion therapy. And a lot of it was actually in New York State, because I'm originally from New York State and I lived in New York City for 10 years. And let me say, New York City is not an easy place to not be gay. I mean, even if you're not gay. And I was like,
don't make me laugh at this.
But see, so there I was like trying not to be gay in New York City, which, you know, and there were these programs in New York City, throughout New York State, that promised that they could make me straight and that it was the way to go. And I spent a lot of time and effort, energy on that.
I want to ask, though, because I know you've talked about this, but I want to make sure I really understand this. Did you really believe that you could do that? And did you really want to, or were you trying to appease somebody else?
great question. You know, you have to remember, in the 80s, when I was coming of age, they talked about gay men or homosexuals as an existential threat to America. We were the terrorist of the day. The way they talked about gay men back then, it was about we need to protect the family, that God's going to punish this nation if we you know, let the gay agenda come through. So there was a lot of panic. Then you had HIV/AIDS added to the mix. And in that toxic soup, it's hard to say if I made a clear decision, but I was panicked. And in that panic, to me, the most logical choice was to not be gay, because I knew the world would treat me better if I were straight. And my church definitely would treat me better. And I wanted to serve in the church as a missionary. So at the time, it seemed logical, but my brain was soaked with fear and shame. And when that's happening in our heads, we don't make good decisions.
Would you have believed it if I told you that you could have a gay president in your lifetime, like an out gay president?
I guess so, because at the time, at least, meaning back then when I was trying.
Sure. To, yeah. Right.
Right. Well, no, because part of the narrative was there was this evil agenda that was trying to overtake people of faith and the secular movement. So, of course, it would make sense that there'd be a gay president because, you know, we believed in this nefarious gay agenda that they were trying to convert and recruit people.
Oh, I see. So you might believe there'd be a gay president, you know, on the grounds that there was something evil and nefarious about that.
That's how that whole
that movement might spread.
Yeah, that world was set up. And, you know, and again, and the other thing I've been thinking about lately, too, like whenever there was an extreme weather event, it was always blamed on the gays, right? There would be some minister somewhere who would say, well, that tornado that touched down 2 miles away at the Motel 6, there was a party going on with a bunch of gay guys. This is God's punishment. You know, you have this crazy. Of course, they said it was the wacky gay lifestyle, but really it was our extreme fossil fuel lifestyle that are causing some of these extreme weather events to become even more extreme. At the end of the day, it is about gender and more than anything else. And that's what I learned in conversion therapy. In the end, they didn't really care about who we had sex with. It was very much about, were we real men? Were we presenting in a masculine way? And that's why they did wacky things like taught us how to play football and change the oil in our cars, thinking that this would make us straight, strangely.
They really did that.
Oh, yeah.
Here's how you know, because if you can change a tire on the side of the highway,
that's right.
You're probably straight.
And when I told my dad that, I was already
the handiest guy I know, by the way, is gay. Just pointing this out. I don't know why anybody ever thought that gay people don't change car tires, but okay, go ahead.
I told my dad this. I was an adult already, in my 30s, at this program in Memphis. My dad's from the Bronx, and I said, "Dad, today in the program they taught us how to change the oil in our cars." And my dad says, "Why would you do that? I just go to Jiffy Lube." I was like, "Dad, that sounds gay. I don't know."
Oh, boy. I've told Peterson, don't make me laugh at some of this stuff, but it's difficult. Okay, so kind of fast-forwarding a little bit here, just give me, and again, we're summarizing big things in short ways here, but what was the moment that you decided, I'm done with this, you know, changing myself, I am who I am?
Like many people who leave an abusive relationship, there's often these little moments that add up. And there were these little revelations about how this is not working, how it was changing me, but not in the ways I wanted. I was becoming depressed and suicidal. But then there was a moment, literally a moment, I woke up in the morning as if I had woken up out of a coma. And why it didn't happen a week before, a month before, a year before, I don't know. But that's how these things often happen. My brain was clear, as if it had been pickled in a jar somewhere and been restored to me. And my thought was, what am I doing? This is insane. And I just realized that this was a foolish path to be on and a destructive one. And that's the part that people have missed out. And this, fortunately, people are understanding. It's not that it doesn't work. It's not that it's silly. It causes harm, deep psychological, emotional, and spiritual harm. That's why I'm grateful for cities and states that have bans on conversion therapy.
It was 10 years ago, reading an interview that you did roughly 10 years ago now, that you touched on something that I think is much more discussed now, but there's still big parts of our society grappling with, which is what is natural, what is normal, you know, what is normal, quote unquote normal. I'm putting the air quotes that no one can see, but natural, because so often, you know, you hear people struggle with transgender questions or gender fluidity, the spectrum of gender, and it is sort of minimized by those who don't want to see either rights expand or sort of acceptance happen. It's minimized in a way that says, well, it's only X percent. How could that be natural? And there's lots of things that occur in nature that don't occur with the same statistical frequency as other things, but we sort of struggle with that. Also, just being gay is less common than, quote, being heterosexual, right? But it doesn't mean it's not natural. Why do we struggle with that question of natural, you think?
I'm so glad you bring this up, because this is partly why I think I never got involved with environmental issues, because I was told that what I feel is unnatural. In fact, back in the day, homosexuality was called a sin against nature. So for a lot of LGBTQ people, we're already told we are not part of nature. And many of us who grew up in rural spaces, I grew up in the Catskills, we had to flee those spaces because they were not safe for us. Yeah, you know, save the owl and, you know, save the black bear, but also save that LGBTQ person in nature, because we feel very unsafe often. It's changing somewhat, but that's why cities become hubs, sanctuaries. So I felt very detached from nature because of this sort of language that's going on.
We're going to end the week with a conversation about jazz and how jazz culture intersects with social justice. Larry Blumenfeld is a cultural journalist and jazz critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's been writing about jazz for decades, and a significant body of his work is about how jazz can be used to make social and political statements. He was sharing that work this week with students at Syracuse University.
In 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, Blumenfeld traveled to New Orleans to examine how the city's cultural scene would rebuild itself after the storm. Here's what he learned over several years.
Began by writing an essay for Salon, and at that moment in time, I knew that New Orleans was flooded. I worried about musicians I knew personally. I worried about a culture that I loved and revered. And I also was confused, because I felt like if one of the great European cities of culture in Italy or Germany, that was known as a birthplace of opera or a certain kind of classical music, were underwater, I felt that the outcry about just that idea of culture might be great. And I wasn't hearing that at that moment. Year after that, I wrote a series of pieces for the Village Voice, may it rest in peace, that publication. And there I thought I was going to write a story about how musicians were getting back, or whether they would get back, and how the culture would be revived. And what ended up happening was a long process where first I realized that even though I was a jazz critic and journalist from New York who thought he knew about New Orleans jazz culture, I knew very little, and I needed to be immersed the way one would be if you're trying to learn a foreign language, to learn what that culture really was, what second line parades and Mardi Gras Indians and traditional jazz really meant as a functional culture that affects people's lives and that defines their sense of identity and place in a much deeper way than we might think, and beyond any sense of entertainment and a music business. And then what I realized was that that culture itself didn't just need to be recovered, but it was the political action in a moment when people were cast out, disenfranchised, and not being at a moment when their representatives in Washington were suggesting bulldozing the whole thing. And that's a direct quote, not a paraphrase. So, and then it's moved on and on. So I can tell you that New Orleans has in some ways recovered and developed into something that people call a new New Orleans, but there's this odd, strange tension between the city and this culture that it identifies with, that it loves, and that it sells, and the people who make this culture. And that tension has intensified. And so some of the musicians that I've spent time with and interviewed questioned, do these time-honored cultures really have a place in the new New Orleans? And for me, I can wrap that into a much bigger idea about, well, what does jazz and jazz culture mean in this country? How do we value it? How do we use it? What does it contribute to our lives and our identities here? So it's a very loaded, and that will be a very loaded presentation by me. It's interesting, I'm glad you read that roundtable that I did, and that was for a magazine that I've been affiliated with for a very long time. And the Trumper you quoted was Terrence Blanchard, who was just nominated for an Oscar for his work with Spike Lee, who scored Spike Lee's documentary.
And to be clear, the Trumpeter, not Trumper.
trumpeter. Oh, ha, yes, no, nothing like that.
It kind of came out as trumper, and I thought, wait a second, oh, trumpeter. No.
The trumpeter who would never be considered a trumper was Terrence Blanchard. And so when, for instance, when Terrence Blanchard is saying that stuff, and when Terrence Blanchard is making music that may have social and political associations or content to it, he's doing it from the perspective of a person who saw his mother's home completely destroyed, who was had to live somewhere else for the better part of a year. So there's, it's not a metaphorical rage. There's no abstraction there. It's quite direct. As a matter of fact, you can see the experience of him visiting that destroyed home in Spike Lee's documentary. So there's that. And, you know, so for me, it's been a sense of discovery, both about a culture that I think most Americans don't truly know or understand, about the fact that it does function as a political action and is the expression of social justice there, and its relationship with a larger idea of jazz culture.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and where else, Megan Mack?
WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, running out the door. I'm Megan, still here on the podcast. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.